This is the legal opinion portion of the speed contest, 5 minutes at 220 words per minute. The first minute will be a minute of warm-up. We will give the starting place for transcription afterwards. Ready? Begin. Tim Cook was convicted of the robbery of a grocery store in San Diego and the first-degree murder of San Diego Deputy Sheriff Charles Wills. He was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. We have jurisdiction to review this case. Cook admitted at trial that he and one Steve Ellis robbed the grocery store and that as they were making their escape in Cook's black Camaro, they were stopped by Deputy Wills, who had stationed himself close to Interstate 10 in order to close off a possible escape route. There was conflicting testimony as to what then transpired. After being stopped, either Cook or Ellis walked to Deputy Wills' patrol car and fired 2 shots into his head. He was killed instantly. A prompt report of Wills' death caused officers Bates and Joy to begin patrolling Interstate 10. They observed and stopped the Camaro after it had crossed into Arizona. Ellis, who was driving, left the Camaro and approached Bates, who began to frisk him. Joy approached the Camaro, observed Cook sitting in the passenger's seat, and returned to his patrol car. While doing so, he heard a shotgun fired from inside the Camaro. At that moment, Ellis pulled a gun on Bates, but Bates reacted faster and shot Ellis fatally. Cook then drove off in the Camaro. Both the officers fired several shots and gave chase, but Cook escaped into the countryside. Cook was captured the next day with a shotgun in his possession after a manhunt by over 400 persons. Before us, Cook has argued that at least 17 errors marred his trial. Many of these alleged errors are devoid of merit and deserve only passing discussion. A few require more extensive analysis. 1. Inadmissible statements. Cook raises a threshold issue of whether he was properly advised of his constitutional rights under Miranda v. Arizona, 384 U.S. 436, and whether a subsequent statement was voluntarily given. The arresting officer, acting to ensure Cook's safety, placed him in a squad car and informed him of his constitutional rights. Cook then acknowledged his understanding of his rights and was taken to a temporary headquarters set up by the police. He was given a refreshment and Arizona officers entered the car. He was then questioned for a short time, at which time he told the same story he would later tell at trial. Although there were some members of the search party in the area around the car at this time, they were orderly and were not shown to have made threats of any sort. The trial judge made a thorough inquiry into these matters, and he concluded that the warning was understood and the statements voluntarily given. We find no reason to reverse the trial judge's determination. The factual circumstances were not inherently intimidating. The trial judge properly inquired to determine whether Cook was coherent and aware of what he was doing. The state had the burden of proving voluntariness by a preponderance of the evidence, and the trial judge did not err in finding that the burden was carried. 2. State violations of criminal rules. Cook seeks a reversal of his conviction on the ground that the state violated the rules of criminal discovery. On Wednesday, June 12, 5 days prior to trial, the state provided defense counsel with the names of 7 witnesses and informed him of the existence of a 4-hour tape recording of police messages, which had been recorded by a private citizen tuned in to the broadcast frequency of the sheriff's office. The state's attorney had learned of these witnesses and the tape only a few days earlier. Defense counsel moved for a continuance in order to conduct discovery and study any new evidence. A hearing was held, after which the motion was denied with leave to ask for reconsideration should any relevant new matters be uncovered. On the morning of Monday, June 17, defense counsel renewed his motion for a continuance. Again, a hearing was held and the motion was denied. At both hearings, it was uncontroverted that the state's attorney supplied defense counsel with the new witnesses' names soon after he learned of them and that all but one were in possession of information which was identical to that known by the other previously identified witnesses. Only one of these witnesses was called to the stand during the trial, and he only testified for a few minutes. The only new evidence of any significance to emerge from these late revelations was the tape, which served to place in chronological order the various pieces of other evidence. Defense counsel failed to complete his review of the tape prior to trial due to his unwillingness to retain possession of the tape out of the presence of the state attorney, fearing the consequence of possible damage to the tape. As the trial date nears, a prosecutor has the duty to promptly disclose previously unidentified witnesses and material. A delay of days might be sufficiently prompt where several months remain before trial, but where a complex trial involving a human's life was scheduled to begin in 1 week, immediate disclosure is dictated by the rule. Nonetheless, failure to obey the rule should be remedied in a manner consistent with the seriousness of the breach. Relevant evidence should not be excluded from the jury unless no other remedy suffices. Here, the trial judge properly denied the initial request to postpone the trial on the ground that any prejudice could be best assayed after defense counsel had the opportunity to depose the witnesses. By directing the state's attorney to act speedily in making these witnesses available, the trial judge did all that was reasonably required at that time. When he later reconsidered the motion, the witness's testimony was found to be cumulative and non-prejudicial. The only hardship then shown by the defense was the failure to have listened to all of the tape, causing an increased burden on defense counsel during the week of the trial. The trial judge concluded that there was no prejudice to Cook's defense and that the increased workload was in part the result of a tactical decision by the defense rather than the state's breach of the rules. Our rules were not designed to eliminate the onerous burdens of trial practice. Their purpose was to avail the defense of evidence known to the state so that the convictions would not be obtained by the suppression of evidence favorable to a defendant or by surprise tactics in the courtrooms. While life sentences clearly command our closest scrutiny, it is still the obligation of an appellate court to review with caution the exercise of experienced discretion by a trial judge in matters such as a motion for a continuance. We cannot say that the judge's discretion was abused in this case. Another breach became apparent when the state announced that a ballistics expert had been mistakenly left off its witness list. The starting place for transcription. At that moment, Ellis pulled a gun on Bates, but Bates reacted faster and shot Ellis fatally. One more time. At that moment, Ellis pulled a gun on Bates, but Bates reacted faster and shot Ellis fatally.